That moms are always doing everything for everyone else has long been an accepted and expected reality for moms, and many try to live up to this impossible demand, this impossible dream. But today's guest questions this pursuit. Hello, everyone. I'm Pamela Brewer, welcoming you to this edition of Mind Talk. I'd like to introduce you to today's guest, Nataki Lee. Nataki, welcome to Mind Talk.
Thank you, Dr. Brewer. Thank you for having me today.
Now, Nataki, I'd like to start with asking you a little bit about you. You have a concern and there's work that you've been doing, but let's start with your beginnings. Tell us about where you were born and what your experiences were as a little one growing up in terms of mothering.
So I was born in Washington, D.C. I was born at Providence Hospital. The story is that my father wasn't ready for children, so he didn't show up at the hospital to collect my mother and me. Instead, I went home with my grandmother and my uncle and my grandmother came to pick my mother and me up from the hospital and brought us home. And my grandparents' home was my home for the first 10 years of my life, more or less. And I lived on a street that was full of grandmoms and granddads. I think that I knew everyone on that street. I was totally loved on by everybody. I called my grandfather Nana for years, actually. I called him Nana. I never knew that it meant granny or grandmother. And so perhaps, you know, I remember when I was about 3 or 4 and I was following him in the grocery store, and I was following him around saying, Nana, Nana, I wanted his attention. He finally took me into an aisle and said, stop calling me that. And it wasn't until college I realized, oh, I'm calling this man a grandma. But he, you know, that was the only time I remember he was frustrated with me. Other than that, you know, he just welcomed the name. And I'm the only granddaughter, the only grandchild that called him that, too.
It sounds like, so you had granddad, you had grandmom, and you had mom.
I had mom. Mom was definitely around, and she was doing a lot of different things. So I remember for a long time thinking that she was my sister and my grandparents were my parents. So I had a very strong connection with them, with my grandparents. And then there was the grannies next door, and they watched me. So I had grannies on both sides and across the street from my real granny and my real grandfather. So I had a lot of grandparents, a whole grandparent support system, and it was lovely. I that was my safe space.
It sounds like it was very supportive and very loving. As a little one growing up, did you have a sense of what you wanted to do with your life or who you wanted to be? Was there any guidance along those lines?
Sure. I had 3 things that I was going to be when I grew up. I was going to be a pediatrician because I really enjoyed children. Even as a child, I enjoyed children. I was going to be a veterinarian because we always had a dog. My grandfather, I think it was my grandfather, who put out traps for the stray cats, and either my mom or my grandmother and I would always free the cats from the cages. My grandfather was most upset, but you know, we were We were freeing the animals. We were letting them go off and, you know, be free. My grandmother fed the squirrels all the time. So every year there was an Oscar the squirrel. So I grew up to really love all animals. And then between those, you know, hours of being with animals and, you know, with children, being my medical career, I knew I was going to be a dancer, a ballerina, and I was going to be Judith Jameson. Her picture, you know, was across over my bed for years. Judith Jameson was it for me. So those are the three things that I knew I was going to do. I was going to grow up and be all three of those at the same time.
So a dancing pediatrician veterinarian, that's quite impressive.
Yes.
For those folks listening who may not be aware of who Judith Jameson, what she represented to you and certainly to the world, tell us, give us a thumbnail sketch of Judith Jameson.
She is a black woman who danced, but she looked like a black woman. I went to a ballet school here in D.C., and the executive director, at some point, the executive director said, well, I would never be a ballerina because my body type, because I'm a black, young black girl, and I will become a black woman, and we have too much butt and too much breast. We're not the type to dance. And Judith Jameson was not, you know, a prima donna, you know, rail thin ballet dancer. She had curves and she wore her hair short. She didn't pull it back in a bun. She had a nicely, you know, neat little fro. And she, gosh, she was, I can't think of the name of her signature piece where she's dressed in white.
Oh, yes.
Wade in the Water.
Yes. And she was an extraordinary dancer.
An extraordinary dancer who did at some point become a creative director for many ballet schools, actually. So, yeah, she broke the mold. She was the first Misty Copeland as far as ballet goes. Yeah, she was the mother of black women coming to ballet and setting our pliés and our tendus in on the stage for us as women of color with not the typical ballerina body and hair.
Quote unquote typical ballerina body and hair. And
quote,
of course,
yeah.
She was an important part of the Alvin Ailey group. Yes. You're welcome. Happy to oblige.
Thank you.
Okay. So you were going to be Judith Jameson, a vet and a pediatrician. Did you decide at any point as you were growing up that that was just a tad bit ambitious? Maybe you couldn't be all those things
really...
at once?
It did dawn upon me.
Oh, good.
At some point. It did dawn. Because of the director at the ballet school, I definitely lost a little faith,
sure.
A little, you know, confidence. And I ended up going to another ballet school that was all African-American girls and teachers. But there was something, you know, there was a little death that came to me when I was told I would never be able to do this on a big stage and have audiences. So I didn't pursue it any further.
You know, it speaks to the profound power of expectations, and it certainly speaks to the power of those who are in a position to teach and mentor. And certainly we know many people and have heard many stories about people whose dreams for themselves have changed once somebody, through their own negativity and their own prejudices, if you will,
mm-hmm.
sort of helped to dash those dreams.
Yes, absolutely. I My mother put me into African dance, and and it was just frustrating from that point on because the teacher would always say, "Oh, yeah, you dance ballet." Because, you know, ballet, you're upright, you're straight up, you're straight, there is no bend or, you know, flex foot. And African dance, you are more earthy to the ground, and you know, you're not so stiff, you move, and you move in circles, and it was very difficult for me to break out of the ballet mode, you know, of dance, you know, straight legs. I even got kicked out of a tap dancing class because of the straight leg piece. It was so ingrained in me, the ballet, that I was, you know, trying other ways of dancing, and people would immediately go, "Oh, you're a ballerina." And that was difficult because I was already told I wasn't a ballerina.
Right, right. I mean, it's just heartbreaking.
So I just gave up dance.
It really is heartbreaking because what you're describing, what so many people go through, so many children, so many girls, certainly so many persons of color, is the notion that there's kind of no place that you fit. When you were a ballerina, you weren't. When you were in African dance, you weren't. When you were in tap dancing, you weren't. It's just... Again, I can't speak to enough to the power of spoken and acted out expectation on people in general, but on children, it is often life-changing.
Yes. Yeah, it changed the entire... That was my number one dream, and it became not a dream at all. It became not a reality. There was no way that was going to happen, so... So that was how I narrowed my list down.
All right, so then you only had two careers to worry about.
Right, and then I enjoyed animals, but not that much. it just kind of became clear that, you know, I like them, but I don't like them that much to want to work with them. So by default, it became a pediatrician, and I actually am really good with children. I ended up what ended up taking place of dance in my life was music. So my mom is a concert pianist, and there was always competition between my getting attention from my mother, the piano, and me. For a long time, that was my sibling rivalry there, the piano. And so I took piano, but I really hated it. And one day she says, "You're going to play the viola." And she put me in DC Youth Orchestra, and I fell in love with the viola. Oh. But I didn't want to make it a career. I just really enjoyed playing it. And one of my first jobs was when the mayor, Marion Barry's first year doing the summer youth program, summer job program here in DC.
Mm-hmm.
My job was being a teacher's assistant for viola, for string instruments, at the Levine School of Music.
Interesting.
And I enjoyed working with the children. Then when I was about 20, and I had been babysitting prior to that, but working in a classroom with children was great. And then I was a camp counselor over in Montgomery County, Maryland. Our camp director got sick and she couldn't continue the work. And so they gave me the job.
Wow.
Of being the camp director at the age of 20. So
wow.
I was the youngest in the whole program. And I loved it and the parents loved me. It was an opportunity to be really creative because we had an outdoor camp. It was a playground and it was me and a few other counselors and children. So it was always challenging to come up with something new and fun and safe every day, but it was great. It was a wonderful experience. And I thought totally I could do this pediatrician job. And then that went away too.
So, little by little, like most human children, all those jobs you were going to do all at once kind of faded.
Yes.
Into what?
Into
what?
Well, now I am a postpartum doula, or I say a traditional postpartum doula.
And what does that mean?
That is a woman.
Okay.
Yeah. The woman who takes care of newborn mothers. Newborn mothers mean women who just had a baby. And so they're in that first 30, 42 days of being a mother. And my job is to help new mothers recover quickly and properly, safely, so that she can take care of her baby and her new family and enter back into, you know, pre-baby life tasks or chores or life in general. Just be able to return to her life. And not to say that her pre-baby life is going to look like the exact same thing as her post-baby life. Just be able to pick up some of those things that she was doing before she had the baby, move back into it with ease and with health. That's my job, to help her transition into that, again, that healthy, easy life with a baby.
Well, healthy I get. Easy, not so much. One of the points,
and I should change that. I say easy. I really mean simple. Make it more simple.
Gotcha.
Because I think easy is very different. And so, yeah, I have to. I always tell people it could be sweet and simple. It's not going to be easy. So I correct myself.
One of the things that you have talked about is the fact that certainly women often believe they should be everything to everyone. And women of color very often have this sense that asking for help is just not what you do. You just suck it up and move along and just do the 4,200 tasks that you have that day, and then the next day you do the 4,500 tasks that were left over from the day before. What's it sounds like your role, though, is to be helpful, to ease the transition. That's what you're describing, and yet, again, women so often think that that's not okay, and are told that it's not okay, and are told to just. People have babies every day, have your baby, and go back to work. Get over it.
Yeah. Get over it. You just had a baby. Don't worry about it. You know, it's not like heart surgery or anything. We really don't understand what's going on with our bodies when we say that. We really don't get what's happening with our bodies, with our mind. You know, we as a society, we focus so much on our external that we can't see what's going on the inside. So it just doesn't make it, we don't make that connection. And we've seen our mothers push through and our grandmothers push through, and we've heard the stories of our great grandmothers pushing through. I feel like I'm a little bit of an exception because I never heard about my great grandmother pushing through. She was one of the very few stories I've ever heard of a black woman being, you know, never having to work. She had five children. My grandmother was the youngest. And my great-grandfather had a store. They were in Goldsboro, North Carolina. And he had a store, and he was the one who said, stay home. Occasionally, she would help him out in the store, but stay home, take care of the children. You know, wear your beautiful hats on Sunday. She kind of was that made woman. And during the Depression, my great-grandfather, I understand, took care of a lot of people in the community. So he was feeding people, you know, from his store, from the store, and bringing food home and feeding people in his neighborhood.
Wow,
and,
amazing. Nataki, I got to tell you that having five children and staying home to take care of them, that sounds like work to me. But I want you to hold your response because we're going to take a break and we will be back in just a moment. Folks, don't go away. My name is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk. Nataki, five children, that's a whole bunch of work in my world.
It is. I have four children, and it's a lot of work. And I'm glad you're bringing that up because, you know, she stayed home. She took care of the people that she gave birth to, that she brought into the world. And that was her only job. That was it. And it is a job. It doesn't pay you dollars, but it does pay in so many other ways. And yet you are giving so much of yourself, day rise, day set. It's a job. And we don't give much consideration. We only focus on the ones that are bringing the dollars in. We don't consider the job that is taking. I mean, I joke, it's a joke, but I do say, you know, I am bleeding for you all. You children, you people that I have here, you know, you lived up inside of me for, you know, 280 days, and then you come out, and then we have to work on this relationship. You know, I have to learn your language. You have to learn my language. And then I have to feed you. And my body is doing all of that work to feed you, to nourish you. You know, who's going to feed me? It's so big. And yet we minimize it because it doesn't bring a dollar into the house. My grandparents, my great-grandparents really understood the job that she had. Taking care of these five people. And I say people because that's what they are. They are, you know, they don't stay babies for long. They become people with opinions. I mean, that alone is a lot of energy when, you know, you're trying to have a conversation with a three-year-old and they have an opinion about whether this is a dress or a shirt. And I'm just trying to get out the door and get them to school. And they want to explain to me why they can't wear the dress. It's emotionally draining. It's depleting.
Absolutely. And not only do they have an opinion, but they are going to hold to that opinion. Fact has nothing to do with anything. Their opinion is theirs.
Exactly. And you have to have the energy to work with these people. You have to have it because... you know, when I have four, and I actually have, so I am a mother of five. I lost my third baby.
Oh, no.
And I learned, this is when I learned that postpartum was really a very vulnerable and super fragile place. It's where we get, where we reset, where our bodies and our minds, our emotions, our spirits need this time to renew and restore. This is a time, that postpartum period, that 42 days right after you have a baby, that's your time to really get quiet with yourself and to do some repair. Your body needs to repair. I didn't know this. I was told by my doctor that, you know, you just, we'll just go in. Baby has stopped developing at 4 months. And, you know, you'll just go and get a DNC and come on out of the hospital. Don't worry about the fetus. And go on about your life. And I thought, that doesn't sound right to me.
Right.
That doesn't jive with me at all. Because I had already started the work. My body had already started the work to
Absolutely.
Connect with this baby to... You know, I'm sick, so definitely your body's already doing the work. It goes into automatic, must make a perfect environment mode for this new person. So your body's already moving, doing what it needs to do to create this perfect environment to grow a person. And when things don't go according to plan, according to the 280-day, the full-term pregnancy, you know, your body goes into shock. What just happened? How do we recover from this? What do we need to do? So my body and my mind, I felt were not connecting
sure.
at that time. I really couldn't wrap my head around this, losing this person. And we had named her and everything. We were all excited. And then, you know, to hear the news that she's not developing, that she doesn't have a heartbeat, and we need to take this fetus out of you. I wasn't okay with that. I wanted to allow my body to sync up with my mm-hmm. heart and my
of
head.
Course.
And
with your spirit.
And my spirit. And I wanted to honor this life. I mean, I really felt like this person, I already have a connection here. I'm already doing, you know, work here. I'm already a parent to this person. Because I'm you know, I can't just discard this part of me. So,
Did you have help or support as you went through the quite frankly, the grieving and the healing process?
So not as much as I would have wanted, and not as much as I know now what I needed. I lost the baby in our home where we were living at the time because, I wanted my body to sync up, and so my body let go when my body was ready to let go.
Mm-hmm.
But I almost bled to death. My husband came home and found me lifeless. So he rushed me to the hospital, and I had 2 blood transfusions. And by this time, I was the caregiver for my grandmother, who had been so much a caregiver for me
mm-hmm.
that, yeah, I was her caregiver. So I couldn't be there for her. My mom and I, by this time, were estranged. So she wasn't there to support me. I don't have a relationship with my father, so he wasn't there to support me. My grandfather had been gone. You know, he died in 96, so he wasn't there. It was just my husband.
And he was grieving, too.
And he was grieving, too. And I recall one day going to church. And by this time, I already had my 2 boys. So we were all in the car going to church. And it was a beautiful day. There was not a single cloud in the sky. The sky was, you know, just super blue. I remember it being incredibly beautiful. And I just couldn't stop crying.
Yes.
I couldn't stop this feeling of being eaten up, just I don't even really have words to describe the hole that was literally physically eating me, you know, crunching down on my bones. It was dark and it was painful. And we arrived at the church, and we were met at the front door by a couple of parishioners, and I don't know what happened or what they said. Oh, I was still showing. I still looked like I, you know, my abdomen was still full looking. So, yeah, they made mention of the baby. And I just fell to pieces right there on the steps. And then that, and my husband, I remember, you know, in my periphery, he was just kind of standing shell-shocked himself while I crumbled into somebody's arms. And what they did is they sent us down to a room in the church, and we sat there, he and I. The children went off to Sunday school. My husband and I just sat there, realizing this was the first time that we, that he was feeling it. He was been supportive of me, and yet he wasn't really in tune with himself. And it was, we had no words except for, wow, this is the first time we're feeling this together. And that was about it. And after that, you know, some parishioners brought us food, but I didn't realize how much my body needed that repair work, that healing. I didn't understand what I was going through, and I couldn't reach out to people. It's not that I didn't try. I did try, and at the time, this was about 8 years ago, and it just didn't seem like maternal health was really being talked about. So there were a couple of therapists that I reached out to, and they were like, I don't know what to do with this.
Wow.
And they couldn't give me a direction. So I started painting on the walls. I'm going crazy here. And so I start painting words like forgive and love and, you know, rose bushes on the walls. My son at the time was, what, 3? And he was like, Daddy's going to spank you. You're all painting all over the walls. When I wrote on the wall, you guys did not appreciate this at all. So he, you know, he was there with me. A lot, and I realized that I needed to not fall apart. I couldn't fall apart because he was home with me, this 3-year-old. And then my husband started staying home with me more. We couldn't afford it, but I did tell him a few times that I was going to have to leave this earth. I just couldn't. I was slipping away, I did find things like freedom, emotional freedom technique. I did start dancing again. My husband would play music, and we would have what we now call Friday family, you know, fun nights or jam sessions, dance-offs. So all of these, essentially the things that I had as a child, that I wanted to be as a child, the things that I learned as a child, I started applying them back into my life. Music, dance. I started feeding a squirrel, and he chewed his way into my house. I was always looking for food. So that was not exactly the best thing, you know, to reconnect with the animals that way. But I started, you know, showing more love to animals, to the people around me. My husband took me into the parking lot that was near us, and we fed the birds. And I remember all of these seagulls, their wings just whapping, whap around me. And it's like they breathe life back into me. Mm. It made me remember something. And from that point on, I just decided that I was going to take these steps to eat better, to be more aware of my emotions and to allow them to come up. I didn't work, and it was very difficult, but I didn't, it was extremely, financially, it was just painful.
Sure.
But it was not as painful as trying to get myself back together to go to work. There were just a lot of steps that I took to find a whole place. My husband and I talked a lot about mind-body connection and the things that I could do to build that connection and strengthen it. My husband is Taoist. He practiced Taoism, so we did a lot of readings. We still do a lot of readings, and and I've grown. So I've grown over these last 10 years, actually. And it's just been a process of healing myself. And I finally feel like I'm in love with myself. So now my mantra is, I don't do anything that doesn't bring me peace and joy. If it doesn't bring me peace and joy, I don't do it. And that's hard.
Yes.
For many people to say, what? That makes absolutely no sense. You know, you have to do certain things. You have to do, this, that, and the other in order to keep food on your table. My grandmother was always quick to say, I don't have to do nothing but stay black and die. That was her comeback. I don't have to do nothing but stay black and die. And I just came to an understanding that that is, we have to decide on our values in life. What are our values? And make decisions based around our values and be committed to it. The reason why I became a postpartum doula or a traditional postpartum doula is because I find in other countries and other cultures, their values are very different than ours. They may not have the economic standards that we have, so they work differently. And when it comes to taking care of...
What have you noticed? How do they work differently from what you see in America?
Well, specifically, from postpartum point of view, I just finished a training with a woman in New York, Valerie Lynn, and she lived in Malaysia for 15, 20 years. And she did a lot of research. She didn't experience birth, but she did have her young son there in Malaysia. So she got a chance to really understand and see what postpartum care looked like in Malaysia. So she has trained me for being a traditional Malaysian postpartum caregiver or a doula. And the difference is, they look at day one after you have the baby. They start treating you that right then and there. And it's with teas and body washes. It's personal care. It is looking at your digestive system and your metabolism and your circulatory system, paying attention to your weakened abdomen and easing those swollen perineum organs. And it's done in a gentle way. It's not invasive at all. So, they're just body sprays and washes, herbal washes and teas. But it's working with the natural world. These are herbs that we have. They're this, warm, keeping the mother's body warm. And then on day five, she gets an abdominal massage or a treatment. And that's amazing because it feels so beautiful, just a warm compress. And I make these Thai compresses by chopping up lemongrass and turmeric and ginger, lime peel, and some other things put in there. And you wrap it up in muslin, you warm it in a steamer, and then you apply it to the mother's belly. And very gentle circular motions. And it's heavenly. And it just feels luxurious. But it's so practical. The benefits are numerous. I mean, we're talking about repairing damaged tissue. We're talking about all those organs that get, pulled up and strapped up underneath. The baby grows big. And so where do your organs go? And they get pushed up into a little corner up on the side of you, maybe on your right side or your left side. And then the baby is birthed and all your organs kind of just fall back into a space, not back into place. They need a gentle easing back into alignment. Big thing is after you have a baby, your body goes from a hot incubator, the perfect environment to raising, growing a person, to a cold space or a cold state.
Nataki, I'm gonna interrupt you because we do need to take a break. But when we come back, I would like you to continue to describe this whole process to us. Folks,
Sure. You're
listening to Mind Talk. We'll be right back. Taki, as you were describing the process, the Malaysian process, I can actually feel my own body feeling more calm and feeling more relaxed. And then I think about what happens in America where you have a baby on Monday, and if it's really complicated, you get to stay in the hospital till Wednesday, maybe. And then you're back home and you're supposed to be doing what you do. Why is the Malaysian approach, and clearly it's important and valuable to you, you are now trained in it, why is that in your view so much healthier and more profound in a positive way than what we do here in America?
Malaysia is the global leader in healthcare right now. They're doing all sorts of wonderful things, you know, tourism, going over to Americans, just Europeans. Folks are, medical professionals are going to Malaysia to study their approach to medicine, to health. And Malaysia has the lowest rate of postpartum depression and anxiety in the world.
Wow.
They're like at 3%. So for me, that's enough. Like, it's, you know, it going into the herbal compress, I mean, it does amazing things. You know, it helps the circulation. It helps, like you said, you know, make you feel more calm. But, you know, dealing with these things early on, as opposed to 6 weeks later, which is what we do in our country, really makes a huge difference because, again, your body has 280 days of shifting and changing and realigning, you know, throwing off different balances, your hormonal balances. Everything is, you know, moved around to create space for this person to enter into the world. Once that person enters into the world, your body has 42 days to optimize this healthy, this healing process. 42 days. And it's a natural, you know, when we give birth, it's traumatic, but it's a natural trauma. It's, you know, we see gazelles giving birth in the wild, in the bush, and they birth that baby and, you know, get the placenta off of the amniotic sac off of the baby, and they birth the placenta, they shake off that trauma. And the baby, you know, has to lay there for a while, and so they have their own little process of dealing with the trauma that childbirth brings. But then they've kind of got to pull it together and get back out there before they get captured by a lion.
Mm-hmm.
And that's their process. I mean, so it's a much more abbreviated process, But they have to bring their nervous system down. We get stuck in the fight or flight pattern if we can't bring our nervous system down. So that 42 days is for human mothers is like the, you know, 4 hours that gazelles have after they have a baby. It's that optimizing that time to heal and repair and to bring your nervous system down so you can get back out there and do what you need to do to live your life.
I would think, as I'm listening to you describe the Malaysian approach, that as mother is feeling more cared for and cared about, that it can actually create an environment within her where she feels safer and more secure in terms of caring for her baby.
Yeah. I mean, that's the whole point, is to help mothers get to that place where she can care for the baby. As a postpartum doula in our society, I find when I've worked for agencies, I am hired to go to take care of the baby. I'm hired to take care of, you know, to sit at the baby's bassinet for 6, 7, 8 hours and take care of the baby. And that's not the way that's not how we want to take care of our children. We want that bond. We want to bond with our babies. We want to understand when they're crying, what that cry is, communicating with us. We want to understand our people. So that as we get older, there is a postpartum doula, Ayurvedic postpartum doula, and Isha Oaks is her name. And her famous quote, and I'm sorry, I'm going to butcher it, but in essence, it is the first 42 days of your baby's life sets the stage or foundation for the next 42 years. And that is profound. It's not just, you know, we're looking at 42 days, you know, to sleep in, you know, to do nothing. I think a lot of moms think that we're doing nothing. And your body is doing an enormous amount of work to repair itself and to restore itself so that you can have not just a relationship with your child, but also a relationship with the people around you and your relationship with yourself. It's about being healthy with, you know, with yourself, your child, your partner, with your community. One of the things that Chinese medicine and Malaysian medicine is pulling from both Ayurvedic and Chinese medicine. And the thing about Chinese medicine is, that I love is that it's about connecting with the natural world. We are all part of the natural world. And so we all have to reside here together in harmony. And how do we do that if our mothers are not being taken care of? Mm-hmm. I feel like that's where it starts. We have to take care of our mothers so that the mother, when we focus on her body, her pelvic floor needs strengthening, and the fat that her body needs to lose, you know, there's unwanted fat that we don't need to have after having a baby, and lose that so we're not facing obesity. Oh, getting nourishing meals in her so that she's not facing diabetes, that her body understands how to break down these sugars, you know, how to break down the fat, and it's not feeling depleted, feeling like it's starving, and so it starts doing its own thing to compensate. We want to get nourishing and warm foods in her so that her body just understands it's being taken care of. And her mind, that's why we have so much, we see so much depression and anxiety, because her mind is flying away. It's stuck in that net of anxiety, that net of fight or flight. And we want to calm her down. We want to bring her some nourishment, some grounding, so that she, like you said, feels safe and feels whole and feels nourished and like she can be vulnerable in this time. Because there is going to be a day where she needs to take care of that baby and be strong and fearless and, you know, go out there and, take care of, you know, herself and this other person. But right now, we want her to just focus on taking care of herself.
I hear you talking about different kinds of doulas. If one wants to access the services of a doula, how do you do that? How do you find one? How do you find one that's a good fit for you? And how do you know what kind of approach is best suited for you? I know I've only asked you 5 questions at once, but...
Yeah, well, you know, I wanted to be 3 things at once, so
well, there
okay.
you go. All right.
Finding a doula is actually pretty easy nowadays. I think, there's so many websites that are full of doula listservs, contacts. And you, first of all, want to know if you want a birth doula and or a postpartum doula. Birth doulas often do postpartum work, but their work as a postpartum doula is different because they're still on call. They still need to, be show up and be there for a baby that's coming into the world. So they often don't see postpartum clients or patients as long as women who are just postpartum doulas.
Okay.
And the trend is postpartum doulas often are hired to take care of the baby, to do light house cleaning and cooking, which are all very important. Those are important pieces, but it's not very common to find a traditional postpartum doula who's actually doing the hands-on work to take care of your body. So I think the best way to approach, hiring doulas is, one, setting up a postpartum plan. Like, people do birth plans all the time now.
Right.
And they want to, birth the baby in the water. They want to have hypnobabies program, they want a midwife. They don't want a midwife. They want to do it at home. I think that's becoming more acceptable and talked about. Postpartum plans are not discussed so much.
It's true.
And I think it's really important when you're looking for a postpartum doula, knowing what you want in postpartum, that 30 to 42 days of healing, what you really need going on in your life. Right now, most women get a little anxious, and so they leave the house in 2 weeks and have to go for a walk. But I think that often just because they don't have that support. So again, your mind is doing a lot of moving. It's not calm. And putting in place, how am I going to have food, for example, meals come to me for the 30 days, not 2 weeks, 30 days. Mamas just don't need to think about cooking.
Okay.
30 days. Just don't worry about the cooking. So who's going to cook for you for 30 days? And it doesn't have to be just one person. It could be various people, including your postpartum doula, finding one that likes to cook. I kind of like to cook.
Okay.
But there are doulas that are really excellent in the kitchen. And then finding doulas who, postpartum doulas who are really, I call them late listening ladies.
Okay.
Because, after you have a baby, you're just overwhelmed. And I don't know, you talk about your birth and it went great. No, it didn't go great. You just kind of, your brain, again, is trying to process all of this. So, I call them listening ladies instead of postpartum doulas. These are the ladies that come over and just listen to you. Listen to you cry and laugh and, be angry, whatever it is that comes up for you. And I think that's hugely important, but we don't give it much consideration.
Absolutely.
Those feelings are real, though.
Absolutely. And I would suggest that having somebody who can be that person in your life, regardless of whether you are having a postpartum doula, a birthing doula, everybody mm-hmm. who has a child really needs to have what you describe as a listening lady, or maybe a man, I don't know.
But
to talk about, to express the huge range of feelings that come up after you've done something so phenomenal as to carry a real life human being inside of you, and now it's not. And there's just so much that comes up that, as you say, people don't allow themselves to feel even though they feel them. Don't allow mm-hmm. women to express, even though, again, they're so clear and so normal and so natural. And even the idea of expressing anger, you know, very often,
yeah.
You know, women in general aren't supposed to be angry. I mean, it's not as bad as it used to be, but women in general are just supposed to be not angry.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
once you've had a baby, and then you're really not supposed to be angry. And that's such a human part of your existence. So I'm, you know, I'm voting for the birth doula, the traditional postpartum doula, and the listening lady. Can I have all three?
Yes. Yes. Yes, all three of us need to be there. And that's the, you know, my last point, you know, really quickly, is that in other cultures, like Native American culture, tribes will say that women giving birth to a baby often are going up to heaven to receive their baby.
Hmm.
And they need a group of gentle, strong, gentle women to bring them back to earth, because you can get stuck in the heavens. And a group, not just one, but a group of women who are going to be strong and grounding and gentle as you go through this transition. So I say yeah to all three, you know, and then some.
I have to say, I mean, as our time winds down today, and to me the time went really quickly, let us know how people who want to know more about what you're doing can be in touch.
Thank you. Well, right now I am working on a website, because as you can tell, there's a lot that I want to say. So creating something that is easy has been difficult for me. Easy to digest has been difficult for me. So the best way to get in touch is by email. My email address is thrivemotherlove@gmail.com.
Terrific. And I know we will have you back on Mind Talk if you are willing to return.
Of course, yes. I enjoyed this time together, and it's always so much to talk about when talking about new mothers. And I say newborn mothers. I have a teacher in Australia, and that's her word that she's coined, newborn mothers, because the creator becomes the created, and she too, just as her newborn is vulnerable in this world, she too is just as vulnerable. So I have more I would love to talk about.
Wonderful. And
in regards to newborn mothers.
We will have you back talking about newborn mothers. And folks, thank you for joining us on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service. It is not intended to replace any work that you may choose to do with a mental health, medical health, or other professional. You can always listen to Mind Talk on demand at mindtalk.org. I'd love to know where in the world you are as you're listening today, so do send an email to me at Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. And remember always, if it's unacceptable, then it's unacceptable. You take care.